The Los Angeles Police Department late last week released a video of police violently arresting Alicia Thomas, a 35-year-old mother of two. Thomas died shortly after being kicked violently in the genitals by police officers during her arrest. The four officers and supervisors involved have been assigned to administrative duties at the police station. Only 2 weeks earlier, in Venice Beach, a bystander's video showed four LAPD officers beating a 20-year-old local college student named Ronald Weekly Jr. Weekly was detained for allegedly skateboarding on the wrong side of the street and was later sent to jail after being charged with resisting arrest. Just 3 days after the Venice incident, another video surveillance camera showed two LAPD officers slamming Michelle Jordan, a 34-year-old registered nurse, face first into the asphalt. And on August 28th, a senior executive at Deutsche Bank, Brian Mulligan, filed a $50 million lawsuit against the LAPD after he was beaten by officers back in May in an alleged case of mistaken identity. In an attempt to clean up the LAPD's image and instill confidence in his department, Police Chief Charlie Beck is mandating community meetings for 21 police stations to discuss why police officers use force and how the various incidents of force are investigated. The LAPD has a long and sordid history of using excessive force that the department under Beck's leadership is trying to move beyond. My guest is Earl Ofari Hutchinson. He's the president of the Los Angeles Urban Policy Roundtable. Welcome to Uprising, Earl.
And thank you very much.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, do you see these incidents as representing a pattern different from what the LAPD has been trying to do over the past few years under Chief Charlie Beck? Or is it just that videos of these incidents are drawing attention to a pattern that already exists?
Well, I think actually a combination of both. I think certainly the videos are playing a big part in drawing attention, certainly on the part of the public, to the practices of the LAPD, in this case, very questionable practices. We're talking about the use of force. So I think the videos are very important there. I mean, we all remember Rodney King and, of course, the importance of that bringing to national attention the issue of police violence, police abuse, and in this case, spotlighting the LAPD front and center. But I think also the pattern part of it, what I've been deeply concerned about, and many others in the community have been very concerned about, is that since Chief Bratton left in 2009, in that three-year period, we have seen, unfortunately, a trend upward in the use of force, and in addition to that, we've also seen a distancing on the part of the command staff and Charlie Beck in dealing with community concerns directly. For example, under Bratton, twice a year they used to have an African-American forum where he would come, the command staff would come, and essentially these would be open meetings. Community would present their concerns face-to-face, and then essentially it would be a good dialogue session. We know that during that period, there was a real effort on the part of the PD, and particularly flowing out of Chief Bratton's office, to number one, keep a dialogue going with the community, be responsive, number two, and number three, most importantly, reduce the use of force. We saw that. Unfortunately, we're seeing a tracking back to the time and place. The dialogue wasn't there, the openness wasn't there, and obviously now the use of force is increasing.
Well, from the meetings that Bratton had and from your experience in the community and any, you know, research you've done on the LAPD, how do you describe the use of force or the policy that the LAPD uses when using force on an individual? Do you have any, is there a formal policy? Is there a certain handbook that they're supposed to operate by?
Yes. The Inspector General and the Police Commission, they have very clear guidelines because, remember, they are the policy-making body for the LAPD. The command staff and Chief Beck, they enforce policy, and also they interpret policy, too. But very clearly in the guidelines, and we've gone over this a number of times with police commissioners, including John Mack, and they've made this very public. Number one, obviously, if you're talking about the use of firearms, the officer's life has to be, there has to be a sense that the officer's life is in danger. There's a clear and present danger and a threat to the officer to require the use of firearms. The use of physical force can only be used, and this is clearly spelled out, Once again, if not only the officer feels that there's a threat to him or her, but at the same time, and it also specifies minimal force to restrain someone, to make the arrest if there's a violent encounter initiated by the other party. And that's clearly spelled out. And there was one other thing, too. The LAPD got into trouble a few years ago when they were caught once again on videotape, this time beating up a quote-unquote suspect on the ground and stomping him, but beating him with a long-handled flashlight. Immediately what happened was the police commission brought down new guidelines, essentially banning the use of this kind of weapon, because the flashlights were weapons and used as such by officers. And so that was a clear policy change. Unfortunately, what's happened is there's a big gap between what's on paper, what's stated about the use of force, and what officers are allowed to do, and in fact do, once they're in the field, and oftentimes away from any not only public scrutiny, but scrutiny of the command staff.
Now, in these incidents in the last few months, two women were assaulted, one of whom died, and a young college student. It's amazing to just even think about, even if one doesn't watch the videos, and I did watch a couple of the videos, to think about four or five highly trained, generally, you know, often heavy set men, in a few cases women, police officers tackling one person. Sometimes the person might be inebriated or weak or mentally, you know, not clear in their thinking. And it just seems like it's, to an ordinary person, seems like overkill.
Well, let me track it back on that. The LAPD and, of course, the police commission, they actually do the release of the figures. And they do this every year. The sheriff's department does, too. What they do in their annual report is they specify use of force, and they break it down, the types of use of force, and also the numbers, and also, I should say, the incident numbers, and also the number of officers involved. Interestingly enough, in 2011, almost 5,000 LAPD officers were involved in one way, shape, or form in the use of force. That's a staggering number.
Wow.
With a department that's, what, about 10 or 11,000. You're talking about half of the officers have had use of force complaints, allegations, or violations. Now, the even more stunning statistic, who actually looks at this? What action is taken? How are they reviewed? And who does the review and make a final determination? What kind of punishment, if any, or discipline, if any, is meted out? Well, the command staff does, and Chief Beck. This is what they found, that in the thousands of cases, or rather the thousands of officers involved in the use of force, 99.5%, in other words, almost a complete wash, no action was taken. The use of force was found to be within department policy. That's a staggering figure. In other words, you're saying all the use of force by thousands of officers, all of them, virtually, they're in department policy, and that there's no grounds for a discipline of the officers. That sets up these videotapes where you saw the skateboarder beaten up, where you saw the woman body slam the nurse, the death of Alicia Thomas, and, of course, the official from Deutsche Bank. The fact of the matter is, if you're not disciplining officers, if you're not holding them accountable, if there is no punishment whatsoever and officers know that, then I think we can connect the dots from there and see what the logical, or in this case, the violent, the very disturbing outcome will be.
Now, the official from Deutsche Bank can afford to hire fancy lawyers and has launched this $50 million lawsuit. But what about poor folks? What about low-income folks who don't have the means? How do they, in the absence of proper discipline, how do they get justice?
It's swept under the rug. Nothing happens. Let's take the case of Alicia Thomas.
And I understand you interviewed her family members at this past weekend's Urban Policy Roundtable.
Well, we've been involved with the family for the past 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. The mother, Alicia Thomas's mother, Sandra Thomas, one of her brothers, Timothy Johnson, and one of her grandmothers, Ada Moses. Essentially, we reached out to them, and they reached back, and we've had conversations with them about Alicia and also the aftermath and what the family wants to see. And one of the things that struck me in response to your question, when it's a high-profile case, whether it's a Rodney King back in the day or this day, Alicia Thomas, or the case of the nurse that was body slammed, and the skateboarder. See, that drew a lot of attention because of the video cam and the press jumped on it. What happens then is attorneys will, in fact, get involved because it's a high-profile case. And so, obviously, it's easier to get an attorney. And that's the case with Alicia Thomas. But what happens with just a routine case where someone is mistreated, someone is abused, someone is violated by a police officer, and there's no video cam? There's no documentation or record whatsoever. It's just that person's word against the word of the officers. I guarantee you, in situations like that, nothing is going to happen. We get a lot of calls, I must say, the LA Urban Policy Roundtable. I mean, I just can't tell you the number of calls that we get routinely each month from mothers and fathers and others. My son was abused by the police or the sheriffs. My son was beaten up. My daughter was arrested. It goes on and on and on. And we feel very impotent because it's like, you know, they look for redress, some justice, something, a voice, and we try to give it to them, but we know at the end of the day it's very expensive trying to litigate against the police department.
And I'm sure, you know, this might be an obvious question, but is it true that the disproportionate number of people who come forward are people of color, low-income people of color?
No question about it. Mm-hmm. No question about it. I would say, and this, again, it's not scientific, it's only anecdotal based on our experience. I would say if we get, on average, anywhere from 10 to 12 calls each month in one way, shape, or form talking about some aspect of abuse, intimidation, violation by a police officer, I would say that out of that 10, let's pick the figure 10, 9, either African American or Hispanic.
I'm speaking with Earl Ofari Hutchinson. He's a president of the Los Angeles Urban Policy Roundtable. We're talking about what seems to be an uptick in police brutality incidents at the LAPD. And this is, of course, not to even look at incidents in other parts of Southern California with police departments in Fullerton, Anaheim, Pasadena, and other parts of our listening area, but just even focusing on the Los Angeles Police Department. Now, these meetings that Chief Charlie Beck has mandated for 21 police stations to discuss why police officers use force and how the incidents are investigated, these meetings don't have a timeline. The dates have not been set yet. And in Los Angeles Times report quoted a spokesperson for Charlie Beck saying that he just expected them to occur in the near future, quote, because it is such a hot topic right now. And I'm wondering if you think that they're waiting for some of the outrage to die down before actually scheduling the meetings.
Well, there's three problems with this and three deep concerns. Number one, they're not generally open to the public. The announcement of the meetings, whenever they happen, are going to be with invited community representatives.
Really?
Selected, designated. And we know who typically in the past have shown up at these meetings. And essentially, that brings up point number two, or problem number two. They're behind closed doors. In other words, when you talk about openness, transparency, and accountability, if you're having meetings with selected representatives of the community, we don't know who they are, and we don't know who's doing the selection and who they represent. And there's no input from the community right away. That raises many red flags about how sincere you are about really grappling with the problems of abuse and use of force. It brings up a third problem. The third problem is during the Bratton administration, I may sound like a broken record, but that's a frame of reference I had when there was a genuine effort on the part of the command structure to really make reform a reality. What Bratton did, he had the African American forums, which I mentioned before, Sonali. Two of them, I moderated. Hmm. I was asked directly by the LAPD, by Chief Bratton, Earl Ofari Hutchinson, would you facilitate in the community, and one of them was at the California Museum. The other was at an auditorium in South L.A. Would you facilitate? It's open to the community. We will have an open microphone. We will make a presentation, the command staff, about policies, procedures, and concerns. And Bratton was there. And essentially, we'll open it up for a dialogue with the community. That's the way you do it, not behind closed doors, not selecting invited folk, whoever they may be, and then hopefully down the line, who knows, at some distant point in the future, you may get a report or you may not get a report.
Now, it seems as though when you do have the kind of community dialogue that did happen under Bratton, does it sensitize members of the police department, rank and file police officers, to be a little bit more concerned when they use force just because they have had contact with the very people or the type of people that they're engaging with?
Well, not only does it sensitize them, also it directly reduces, modifies, and in many cases eliminates the use of force, because now officers are real partners with the community. They're coming to community events. They are actually, let me even give you a better example. The LA Urban Policy Roundtable, for 3.5 years, we had our weekly roundtables at Lucy Florence Coffee House in Leimert Park. I can't tell you the number of times, Sonali, that we had command staff, including Bratton several times. We had deputy chiefs. We had watch officers. We had line officers. They would come, and they would not only make presentations, they would be part of the audience. So they would sit. They would listen. They're interacting. They're dialoguing. They get to know the not only the community groups that are involved and the stakeholders, but individuals. So, in other words, it puts a real human face on it. And it's really difficult for officers, particularly the higher-ups that come in and really pass down policy and implement policy to the line officers, to come in, sit with me and sit with others, and then go out and be abusive. That just doesn't make sense. So when you had that model that was in place then, you really began to see the change. If I could mention one other thing where I saw a change. Remember, we're going back into the past, what was, in terms of reform and how it should be brought about. When the police academy, when they have their graduation ceremony, I was an honored guest. I was a special guest, sat right next to him, of Chief Bratton, and actually reviewed the officers. I heard him make the speech and with looking over his shoulder at me, saying, if there's any abuse, if there's any violation of citizens' rights and civil liberties, you are not going to be on this police department. That is the message that has to be sent from the top to the bottom. And when that message is sent, I guarantee you, you will not see the kinds of situations that we have seen over the last few weeks.
Let's finally turn back to the case of Alicia Thomas, whose family you have been in contact with. This particular incident resulted in, well, we're not sure whether it was caused directly by, but at least the police beating of Alicia Thomas was followed by her death, 35-year-old mother of two. Do you know, or how much does the family know about what caused her death?
Well, they're searching for answers at this point in time. They really don't know a lot. They do have attorneys. As a matter of fact, Sonali, interestingly enough, one of the attorneys involved is Benjamin Crump, the attorney for Trayvon Martin. So he has been retained by one of the family members.
And I understand he's also representing Ronald Weakley, Jr.
He's representing Ronald Weakley, too. So my guess is that the way the system works, the LAPD does not, they haven't been the best in the world when situations like this come up, very questionable deaths, violent encounters, to releasing fully what went on, step by step, how this happened. In other words, full public disclosure. Almost always what happens is it's under investigation. How many times have we seen that? And there will be at some point in time, which, by the way, is up to the chief. It's his purview to release the findings. And almost always, that's months down the line, sometimes years down the line, how long is the memory of most people in terms of remembering and focusing on a situation like that? Family members will, but the general public has moved on. And that's one of the gaping flaws in terms of public disclosure. It should be immediate, and it should be exactly that, fully public disclosed. And that has been one of the glaring weaknesses of the LAPD.
Well, Earl Ofari Hutchinson, what resources can you finally recommend for our listeners who want to stay on top of these issues and follow these particular incidents as well as future incidents that might arise? Are there online resources?
Well, actually, no. The LAPD, of course, they have their website, and the police commission. They have weekly meetings on Tuesday. There is a public comment section at the police commission where people can come up and voice their concerns. And supposedly, at times, the police commission will issue reports, inspector general, to letting people know about what's going on, new policies, procedures, changes, use of force. You know, that is there. So that's one resource, and then the website. The other, if I could, you know, put this out, because we feel that they are very good. They do great work. And that's a Ceasefire Coalition. They have weekly meetings, and they do a lot of monitoring of police activities and the Sheriff's Department, too. And so I would strongly urge your listeners to check out Ceasefire, the Ceasefire Coalition, because they right now are really on the point when it comes to dealing with police use of force and other violations and just being a good monitor of the LAPD.
I want to thank you very much, Earl, for recommending that. And how can listeners check out your Urban Policy Roundtable?
Well, we have two websites, laurp.org, laurp.org, and then my website, thehutchinsonreportnews.com.
That's laurp.org and thehutchinsonreportnews.com. We'll link to those from uprisingradio.org later today. I want to thank you again so much for joining us.
Okay, my pleasure. Take care.
Earl Ofari Hutchinson is president of the Los Angeles Urban Policy Roundtable, and we've been talking about a number of recent police brutality incidents linked with the Los Angeles Police Department. He also recommends the Ceasefire Coalition to find out more about police brutality in LA.